science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
All right. So, I didn't really do my research today.
Oh my God.
To be honest,
I'm sorry this came through late. So,
no, it's yeah. 6:35 this morning. Yeah. Every time, you either send it like at the right time in the afternoon, or you send it very early in the morning, which tells me that you are a very early bird.
Well,
good, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know. But yeah, so I've got like big titles. So the first one is about smelling, but.
Yep.
I was told to ask, have we figured out how we can smell yet? So tell me more.
Well, the jury's still out on that, and that's the interesting thing. You'd think such a fundamental thing as the smelling process, if you want to call it that, would be known by now, how it all works and everything. And
not really.
Yeah, no, not really. There appear to be two very sort of distinct sides to this argument as to how it all works. So the first side, basically saying that molecules have got a particular shape, okay, and we've got all these receptors in our nose that are specific for particular shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens when a particular odorous molecule comes along, goes up your nose, finds this receptor, plops into the receptor, that causes the receptor to change shape, and that then causes a message to the brain, which basically says, this is what this smells like.
Okay.
Now, it's been estimated that we have got, or that we could possibly smell about a trillion different smells, apparently. Some people, again, don't necessarily agree with that. So that's a truckload of different receptors, which are all sort of, you know, specific for one particular shape. So, a guy by the name of Luca Turin, about 20-odd years ago, came up with, a reinvention of an alternative theory. And the alternative theory is all to do with the vibrations of molecules.
Okay.
And that it is, in fact, the way in which molecules vibrate in the nose that leads to us perceiving how they smell.
And not the shape of the receptor.
No, not the shape of the receptor, okay? Now, this was first sort of proposed in the 1930s or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we can very easily make molecules vibrate. All you've got to do is to give them the right energy and they'll vibrate. Molecules are vibrating all the time just because of thermal, the temperature, basically. So, you know, all the molecules around us are busy going, you know, vibrate, vibrate, vibrate. And he was thinking, okay, so every different molecule has got its own particular vibrational fingerprint, what we call it. So it doesn't vibrate like any other molecule at all. And so he was thinking, okay, so maybe that's sort of a specific thing and that is somehow related to smell. So they did some experiments. They've done, in fact, lots of experiments. And this is where it gets a little bit chemistry-y.
I know. I'll give it a go.
What do we know about deuterium, folks?
Never heard of it.
Why do you even ask?
We're going right back then. Okay. Isotopes. Isotopes. We know about isotopes.
No. Well, Dara, maybe. I don't know.
I thought I was going to say it had something to do with triangles, but then
No, that's isosceles. Triangles. Yes.
They
okay.
Sound the same.
Right. We're
okay. You're trying. Better than me.
Right. So there's a thing called hydrogen, which we know.
Yes.
Okay. Now there's a heavier version of hydrogen called deuterium.
Okay.
Which is identical to hydrogen in every way except it's double the mass.
Okay.
Okay. And because it's double the mass, if you swap all the hydrogens in a molecule for deuteriums, it'll vibrate differently.
Okay.
So that's the big test of this particular vibrational theory of how this works. You take a molecule that smells, you replace all of the hydrogens of the molecule with deuteriums, which doesn't alter the chemistry of the molecule at all, but it alters
the vibration.
It alters the vibration, okay? And what they've found in some... So it keeps the same shape. That's the important thing. When you replace the hydrogens with deuteriums, the shapes are the same, so therefore it should go to the same receptor in the nose if the shape's important. And they should smell the same.
Yes, because they've got the same
receptor.
Yeah.
Now, what people have found in some experiments is that when you take all the hydrogens off and replace them with deuteriums, they smell different.
Okay.
And so the receptor theory doesn't agree with that, and the vibrational theory does because they vibrate differently with deuteriums on there. So there's basically the reason I bring this up now is there's just been a review paper published on this, basically sort of looking at all of the history of this particular theory and, you know, whether or not it's going to be useful, whether or not people think that it works or not. And again, from reading it, there seems to be two distinctly polarized sides as to how this whole thing works. So short answer, or long answer to your short question is we're really not sure as to how this works.
But
as usually happens, more research is required, you know.
Yeah.
More money. So,
all right.
So that's the guts of it. But I think it's fascinating that we really don't know how this works.
Yeah, it's true. There are still a lot of fields that we haven't sorted out.
Oh, but Lillian's in.
Sorry, I'm just trying to jump. Because I think some people can smell better than others. That's a thing, right? Mm. If we can apparently smell a trillion things,
does
it just mean some of us are less good at smelling those things?
Or perhaps less trained, I think. I think you get sort of sensory scientists who I think they sort of train up their noses to sort of smell things. I think possibly we've all got the potential to do that or something. But
okay. Vibrations or...
Well,
receptor shape.
Well, who knows?
Who knows? So many unanswered questions.
I'm just waiting for the chance, you know, about the old joke about my dog's got no nose, you know, how does it smell? Terrible, you know.
I don't know that joke. That's all right. I'm not from here, so maybe that's why.
It loses something in translation, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. All right, we're gonna move on. But we are talking about psychology tests that are not good.
Well,
basically.
Indeed. And I guess sort of in some references they call them psychology tests and others they call them social science papers. So I think we've already done this sort of the psychology one because they had a study a while back about sort of psychology studies which couldn't be replicated.
Mm-hmm.
They've now gone on to these social science studies and looked at papers that have been published in both Science and Nature. Now, those are the two top basically journals in the world. If you can get into there, mm-hmm. you know, it's all good. And you normally think that the best of the best papers are published in those journals. And, you know, everything that you read in there is unimpeachable. Well, apparently it's not. And so there's a place called the Center for Open Science, which is in Virginia in the States, and they picked 21... Whoa.
Sorry about that. Just scratching my eye.
They picked 21 social science papers that had been published in both Science and or Nature, and they set about replicating them, which is a thankless task because this has already been published, so they're not going to find anything new. And B is going to cost them a hell of a lot of money too. So I don't know where they get all this money from, but it costs them over about $200,000, I think, to replicate these studies. And what they did was they got in touch with the original authors, and, you know, that was all open and everything and transparent, and they used bigger sample sizes than the original authors did to make sure the statistics were even better than what the original authors were doing, okay? Mm-hmm. And... So, as an example, so one of the studies that was published in Science or Nature was that viewing a picture of Rodin's The Thinker made people's religious beliefs weaker.
Now, that seems like a little bit far-fetched to begin with. Who came up with this?
How in God's name did that get into Science or Nature?
I don't know. Who decided that there was an interesting correlation there that you needed to look into?
Absolutely no idea. And another paper was that washing your hands leads to less muddled thinking.
Well, that's interesting.
That doesn't even make sense.
No.
So, surprise, surprise, those were two of the studies that couldn't be replicated. So basically what they're finding was a 62% replication rate.
Wait, but in order to get into those papers, surely it would have had to be peer-reviewed.
Oh, yes, indeed. It had to be peer-reviewed. And this, you know, is maybe saying, oh, maybe peer review is not all that it's cracked up to be, A. Or B, maybe there were very, very big-name people who basically submit their stuff to the higher impact journals and the reviewers just think, oh, yeah, it must be good because these are these big-name people.
Yeah, why should we question it?
And exactly, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so there is a bit of a problem here.
Yeah.
So this is 38% of studies basically non-reproducible in the social sciences in the very, very best scientific journals in the world. So
yeah, that's a bit worrying, I guess.
Yes, it is. So and the other funny thing was that they recruited a couple of hundred scientists and they gave them the titles of these papers and they said, right, which ones do you think we're going to be able to reproduce? And basically, they figured it out. They got 18 out of 21 right. So they knew which ones were reproducible and which ones were crap. Mm. So,
which means that from the very beginning, there's something wrong with those studies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you would think so.
What happened to those studies in that they replicated?
That has yet to be decided now. So this has been published in Nature Human Behaviour. So that's a Nature journal. So what is going to happen to the original studies that couldn't be replicated? I don't know. Are they going to be retracted? I'm not sure. But really, those authors, wouldn't want to be them. But, you know, good on them for actually sort of participating in all this and everything, knowing full well that things might not be reproducible. But
I guess so, unless they actually thought that they got it right. Who knows?
Yeah.
All right, we have to move on again.
We shall.
To our last topic, which is about this botch execution that happened in the States. And it was all about it could be due to the lethal, like the drug that was used for the lethal injection.
Okay, so here's a question for you all, and it's a very morbid question. How would you like to die?
Not by lethal injection?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't want to die. Like, you know, it'd take 14 minutes to die.
There we go. We're just breaking the story for you. We don't have time, so we're just...
Right, so number one, you want it quick. Number two, you want it painless.
Yeah.
Don't you? Or probably painless and quick. You know, whichever way around. Okay.
Definitely these two.
So, there was a couple of weeks ago, there was a guy executed in Nebraska, as you say, and he was executed by lethal injection. And so their lethal injection in Nebraska comprises four compounds, one of which is fentanyl, which is the first time this had been used. And so that's kind of a party drug in very, very small doses. It's the thing that did for Prince, unfortunately.
I think it's also used on the streets with quite dire consequences.
So you've got to be very, very careful with this stuff. So apparently, as the execution proceeded, the guy started going red and started heaving his breath and everything. And so they had to pull the curtains and everything. So we don't know what happened in those 14 minutes behind the curtain, but you can probably guess it wasn't too crash hot.
Yes.
So as a result of this, or sort of contemporaneously with this, I guess, there were a quarter of the death row inmates in Alabama have signed a request or a petition or whatever to be allowed to be put to death using gas rather than the lethal injection because they're scared that the lethal injection is going to, you know, not be very nice and everything. And they've chosen nitrogen gas. And apparently three states in the US now have got this on their books, that they can use nitrogen gas as a lethal gas to kill you. And, you know, all it does is just, it works by displacing all of the oxygen. So you just fill the room with nitrogen, there's no oxygen in there, and you just presumably quietly nod off.
But how do they know nitrogen will be better?
That's exactly the question.
Yes.
I was hoping you'd say that, How do they know it's going to be better? They don't. And so the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, have got on board and said, no, you can't do this because this is cruel and unusual punishment because it hasn't been tried out before, and essentially you're going to be experimenting on humans as guinea pigs.
Yeah, it's not exactly that you can just and try it.
But I mean, they're going to die. Shouldn't they, I guess, get to choose how? Like, have some say?
I'm not totally against you with that. I can see where they're coming from with this. But, again, the cynics out there have said that they are doing this just because they know that it's going to lead to all sorts of legal impediments to their execution because it's going to be appealed and appealed and appealed and appealed. True. Precisely for this reason, that it's a new form of punishment.
This is probably not a bad thing.
Don't have a death sentence.
Well, that's an answer.
Also, Lillian. We won't go into that side of things because Dara's a criminologist student. Everyone should put that out there. But Alan, we were discussing not so long ago that you had concerns about the justice system making decisions.
Oh, geez, are we starting this up again?
I'm not going back there. So Dara's just said, shouldn't these people have the right to choose how they die?
Yeah.
And then, but if you're saying that we don't have enough information about the effects of this gas, are they not? They're not really making a decision with informed.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yep. What we do know is it's going to kill them.
Yeah, which
that much is certain. As will the lethal injection and everything. I think it's just a matter of, you know, the pain and suffering and how long it takes and everything. So. You know, a bullet was pretty quick back in the day, wasn't it? And then they decided to do away with shooting and they got all fancy and everything. And
Just
forget the whole death penalty thing anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we can probably have consensus around that. But in terms of the drugs, you sort of mentioned that I mean, using this new drug, why did they even use that?
Because, of course, the drug companies who would normally make the chemicals that are used in lethal injections don't really want to be associated with lethal injections, obviously. And I think a lot of them are based in Europe, and basically Europe is very much opposed to the death penalty, and so they don't want their good name sullied with this sort of stuff. So basically they've stopped supplying these drugs, and so the Americans are now sort of on their own, and they've got to come up with these cocktails of things that will do the trick. And I guess as Marcus pointed out, you know, before when we were talking about this, when you have an operation, you know, you're put under very, very, you know, painlessly and everything. You don't feel a thing. Just give them a little bit more, or, you know, slice a vein or something like that. You know, it can't really be much less painful, or, you know.
Oh, right. Maybe we should.
Marcus,
on. just one thing though. A listener is saying, interesting that the use of fentanyl is thought to have made a man become short of breath when it's usually when it usually causes the opposite, respiratory depression, as it's is a central nervous system depressant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. And plus they had three other things in there as well that were doing goodness knows what. So, yeah.
It's a bit blurry. Indeed, we don't really know what happened.
Well, basically, again, how do you do the experiment where you've got this whole sort of, you know, four different drugs and everything? What's it going to do? You're not going to use it on humans unless you're trying to kill them. So, yeah.
Well, isn't that what they did? They just tried it on this guy.
I think
there speaks the criminologist. Yeah.
Just to sort of wrap up that section, because it was quite, I mean, we're dealing with people's lives here and we're talking about people's lives, so we just want to, let's just say we'll be careful about that, and we're discussing essentially the compounds in the drugs.
Oh yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That sort of issue, right?
Yes, yep. No, most definitely.
But that's probably a discussion for another day, another topic.
So that brings us to the end of DSO.
It does, yes, yes.
Marcus, maybe next week you can get some lighthearted topics. Would be good. thank you very much, Alan.
Not a problem.
You're off for how many weeks?
For 3 weeks, yes, over in sunny Europe, so yes.
Yeah, have fun.
Be nice.
And so, Marcus, we'll see you next. I just see Lillian telling me to go quick, so... There you go, wrapped up. Marcus, we'll see you next week, and thank you again for doing this.
That was Dear Science.